Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two matters remaining on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Texas Workers' Compensation Commission and others versus Hector Garcia and others from Maverick County, and Clyde Urquhart Sr. versus the First Corporation, doing business as Houston Chronicle Publishing Company, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The court will have allotted 35 minutes for each side to present oral argument in the first cause. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by so advising our marshal, and 20 minutes for each side in the second cause with the same rules. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each oral argument. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. You may make application with the clerk of our court if you wish to hear a tape of these arguments. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in the Workers' Compensation Commission versus Garcia.
May it please the court, Mr. Hicks and Mr. Ratliff will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hicks will open with the first 13 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm Renee Hicks, representing the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission, and Todd Brown as Executive Director. This, of course, involves the 1989 Workers' Compensation Act, which, it's important to note for the court at the very beginning, is not the product of some last-minute sloppy patch job on an old system. It was the product, instead, of a year and a half worth of intense study by staff and legislators using one of the highest funded budgets ever used for a legislative revision in Texas. It was the product of three hard-fought legislative sessions in the Texas legislature. And, maybe most importantly, it was the product of a widely held view shared by the legislature and written into the directions for the study in the first place that the old system of workers' compensation was on the verge of collapse. Against this backdrop, the plaintiffs have raised a facial challenge, and that's important, it seems to me, for the court to keep in mind, a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the Act. And they've asked you, against this backdrop of all this legislative work, all the details that were hacked out over time and compromised over time, to disregard what the legislature has done, basically, to disregard the facts that were developed that ended up being ensconced in the statute. In their place, what they ask you to do is bind yourself in kind of a blind fashion to a set of facts that purport to be adjudicated facts but aren't, developed before a trial judge, a single trial judge. I don't think there's anything in this court's jurisprudence for how you attack or review facial constitutional challenges, how you view separation of powers doctrine, and how you review challenges to statutes such as this that permits that kind of disregard of what the legislature has done. And I think that's a basic thing the court has to keep in mind. As recently as April 28th, this court has pointed out how important it is not to forget in your jurisprudence your deference to the legislature. In the Trinity River Authority case, eight members of the court joined in an opinion where it is pointed out that in equal protection challenges, due course of law challenges, essentially, the court is supposed to look to what the legislature could have had in mind. It doesn't look to the details of some case that's developed at a trial court level. It's supposed to look to what the court, what the legislature could have had in mind when it developed the various classifications in the statute. It also pointed out in that the Trinity River Authority opinion and reinforced the old decision of Le Bon from 1955 about how you approach open courts review on these when you substitute a new set of remedies and rights for an old common law right. And it emphasized that you look to the adequacy of the new substitution and or to the strength of the reasons as compared to the deprivation that might occur when people have to opt out of the old system. I hope to focus most of my detailed remarks at this point on the American Medical Association guides for permanent impairment and on the question of jury trial that's been raised.
Well, you suggest generally that the court should look to the legislature, this court should, and you said something to the effect of, and shouldn't worry about the facts developed in some particular case. Are you referring to trial court findings of fact?
In this particular case, yes. I think
and as far as the trial court's findings of fact, whether it is in this case or in any other where there is a constitutional challenge, are we to accord any deference to those findings of fact, or are we to simply substitute our own political statement of facts?
Not your political statement of facts. You're supposed to substitute your view of what the legislature might have had in mind and what the record shows the legislature did have in mind. But in the only area in this particular case, being it being a facial challenge, the only area in this particular case where the facts that developed at the trial court really have any impact on binding this court or hemming this court in is possibly in the area of standing, which no party is raising at this point. But that's the only area where the facts developed there have any relevance to the constitutional inquiry that's supposed to be made at this point. The court is not, the hearing below, the trial below, most of it was essentially the equivalent of a committee hearing before the legislature. It was revisiting the various policy reasons for why the act, parts of the act should have come out one way or the other.
Is the state's position then that we should ignore all the findings of fact made by the trial court?
Well, there are so many findings of fact that there may be some buried in there that have some particular meaning here. I don't think the court should ignore the findings of fact about standing. I think those have some significance. You put them into the legal context that you've established for standing. But in terms of findings of fact about how the act might ultimately operate once it gets into operation, yes, I think it should disregard those facts.
And what's the basis for our ignoring those findings of fact?
That is not the appropriate way in this court's jurisprudence for assessing facial constitutional challenges to legislative enactments. I don't think this court has ever done that kind of thing for a facial challenge to the legislative enactment.
Regarding the facial nature of this challenge that you've emphasized, do you contend that it's the plaintiff's burden to show that there's no set of circumstances under which this act can be constitutionally applied?
I think that is the basic approach. I know that's the basic approach the United States Supreme Court and the federal court system applies to facial constitutional challenges, and I think it's appropriate for this court to take the same approach. The state should not be forced at this point to do as I think the plaintiffs would have us do, and as I think the Court of Appeals approach would have us do. We should not have to prove that there can never arise a circumstance in which the act won't have some unconstitutional effect. It may happen down the line as this act becomes implemented that a particular fact situation will arise coming through the courts in any one of the numerous areas that are targeted by the plaintiffs here. Jury trial, use of the guides, 15% threshold for supplemental income benefits. Any one of those areas, a particular fact situation may present itself that may present problems for the court in a particular fact situation. But a facial challenge, the state does not have to, at the beginning of the implementation of a statute as complex as this one and as far-reaching as this one in terms of its effects on workers and their employers across the state of Texas, have to prove that it can never have an adverse effect in a constitutional sense. And yet that is what I think this court is being asked to do by the plaintiffs. It's being asked to say, well, there might arise a situation where virtually any person would say that isn't fair, and it's so unfair, in fact, that it bends the due course of law provision of the Texas Constitution. It's so discriminatory that it bends the Equal Protection Clause of the Texas Constitution, or some situation like that. But I don't think that is the state's burden at this point. And I don't think it's the court's burden to involve itself in surmising every possible application over the next 20, 30, let's say it lasts as long as the old one, 50 years of this statute, say nothing bad's ever going to happen in a way this court might not invalidate.
Several other courts have struck down part of their state's statutory reliance on the AMA guidelines, as I understand it.
As I understand, that has not happened. I can't say I've reviewed every case that's been decided involving the AMA guides, but I did review the cases from Florida, Georgia, and Arizona that are cited in the plaintiff's brief. And in those cases, I don't think there's a one of them where they struck down the statute or the part of the statute that has to do with the guides.
Or its applicability.
In some instances, they said its application here is such that you can go outside the guides. The wording of those statutes was also different. Florida statute, I can't remember the exact wording, but it had something that didn't tie it down to use of the guides. And they said, in this particular instance, for this particular person, I think this was a knee injury situation, for this particular person, there was testimony before the commission or whatever they call their workers' comp administration agency. There was testimony before the commission that was medical expert testimony that supported going outside the guides in this particular instance and attaching a different impairment rating. But I don't think there's a case, at least not the ones that they've cited, that strikes down use of the guides. It just says...
And that's not what I meant. I'm in these states, are you contending that those were not at all facial challenges, but were merely applied challenges in a particular set of discrete facts?
I don't think there's a single facial challenge in the cases that were canvassed from other states by the plaintiffs. And as I recall, there was a Georgia decision, an Arizona decision, and several Florida decisions. All those come up in a particular situation.
How many states have upheld the guides as against the Constitution's challenge?
I honestly don't know. None have struck them down facially. How many have upheld them against the constitutional challenge? Your Honor, I just don't know.
Has any?
I just don't know.
Has any state attempted legislatively to use the guides in the form that the Texas statute uses them?
There are variations in the way they are used across the board, from they're just a guide with this add-on, or they bind you, and so on. And it's my understanding that approximately 6 to 8 states try to tie down the guides and impose the objectiveness of them in the workers' compensation system in a way similar to Texas. One of the problems with what we're talking about here is we don't know how precisely at this point, because there hadn't been a case-by-case adjudication yet, how this statute ties the workers' compensation system down to use of the guides. The best example of that, excuse me, you were going to answer.
I gather from its brief, the Medical Association doesn't think very much of using the guides in this fashion. Is that something this court should consider?
I don't think the American Medical Association sets the constitutional standards for this court. And I don't think their explanation of the way the guides are used are, in fact, the way the guides are used. They hone in on the fact that the guides are used for impairment ratings. And I think there's somewhat of a sleight of hand, both by the AMA and its amicus brief, by the Court of Appeals in its approach to this case, in discussing the way the guides are used in the system. The guides are just one step in the computation of two types of income benefits. They aren't the only step, and it's very crucial, it seems to me, for this court to keep that point in mind. For the long-term benefits, the closest thing to long-term benefits, under the system, under the old system, for long-term benefits under the new system, supplemental income benefits, it is crucial for this court to keep in mind that wage replacement or lost wages or lost earning capacity is a factor in the computation of those benefits under the new statute. It is not ignored. The guides are just one part of the computation of those benefits. The guides determine eligibility. The next side of the equation is when you compute how much compensation is to be. This is setting aside temporary income benefits, medical benefits, and so on that the person may be entitled to, and impairment income benefits. When you get to the long-term benefits, supplemental income benefits, and you compute how much person is entitled to, you're taking into account how much that person has lost in capacity of earning wages. It's a much more objective fashion of determining that factor than under the old system. And the reason it's a much more objective fashion is it looks at what the person's actually making after the injury, compares it with what the person actually made before. And so it seems important that the court keep that in mind. the impairment rating system is not, it turns out that impairment isn't the only basis for the compensation. You have to put in both sides of the equation, multiplication of the equation, if you want to call it that. I want to come back briefly, my part of the time is up, I want to come back very briefly just to say, we don't know yet all the details about how the guys are going to be applied in practice. Section 4.24 of the statute is the one that ties the compensation system down to a particular edition of the guides. And it says that the ratings shall be done in accordance with those guides. We don't know what this court ultimately is going to say in accordance with means. We don't know, for instance, if it turns out that there are gaps in coverage or ratings under the guides or ostensible gaps, whether the court might read those and say, well, it can be done in accordance with on a case-by-case basis, or whether the court might say that the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission, through its rulemaking power it has under the statute, can fill in those kinds of gaps. We simply don't know that yet. That's a problem with this approach in this case.
Those are some of the kind of issues that the insurance companies in this case say they will need lawyers to establish precedents concerning.
Well, on the rulemaking side of that, I don't think that's so. In the case-by-case adjudication, if that turns out to be a method that's permissible, which may not be, but if it turns out to be a method that's permissible, I think that's so. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Hicks? Thank you, Ken.
May it please the court, my name is Shannon Ratliff. I'm here representing the intervenors in this case. At that time, it's the Texas Association of Compensation Consumers. It's now the Business Insurance Consumers Association, which is a broadly based association of companies, large and small, who acquire and carry workers' compensation insurance. First of all, if I could, I didn't know I'd say anything that dramatic. If I could, let me address the question.
Somebody's leaning on a switch on the back of the room.
Let me address what I believe to be an overall question, and then I want to go into the particular circumstances that were seized upon, in my judgment, by the trial court and the Court of Appeals to invalidate this act. What both the trial court and the Court of Appeals attempt to tell this court is that the legislature acted arbitrarily and unreasonably in replacing a common law fault-based system, which according to plaintiff's expert would deny any compensation to 80% of injured workers in this state. And they replaced it, and were arbitrary and unreasonable in doing so, they replaced it with a no-fault system, which guaranteed lifetime medical benefits, up to 2 years of tax-free wage benefits, compensates for alterations in the health status for up to 7.7 years, pays lifetime benefits for certain scheduled injuries, pays death benefits to spouse for life and to children until 18 or enrolled in an accredited educational institution to age 25. That's only the part that deals with the compensation. Mr. Babitsky, one of the plaintiff's experts in this case, said because of the problems of proof of fault in industrial accidents and because of lack of solvency of the defendants, that 80% of claimants pursuing common law claims would not receive any compensation. Now, I would submit to this court that it is certainly not unreasonable, it is certainly not arbitrary for the legislature to say that sort of sure, certain remedy is a more than adequate substitute. And I am setting aside the fact that this act, for the first time, empowers the commission to require carriers, even over their objections, to begin the payment of benefits immediately, and all the testimony and all the legislative record says that the immediacy of the benefit is extremely important. Now, the question has been asked with regard to the AMA guide. My understanding, Justice Doggett, is that I believe perhaps in Florida there was either a legislative adjustment, there has been some adjustment made to the guides. But I would cite you to a amicus brief, which I think was only filed yesterday, a reply brief by the American Insurance Association. On page 25, it cites from a 1994 Florida Court of Appeals case, again talking about the AMA guides being the required guides. And it also speaks to this question of facial challenge and the question of whether in a facial challenge you can take into account these particular instances. In that case, the court held, and I think properly so, you do not. That will come up in the litigation of a particular worker's injury. Yes, ma'am. Excuse me.
Under the Act, impairment is synonymous with disability. Is that correct?
No, ma'am. In fact, that is the big complaint that both the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and the plaintiffs have. They say that traditionally in Texas, we have compensated workers on the basis of lost earning capacity or disability. And they say that that is constitutionally mandated. You cannot change that and go to an impairment-based system. Impairment deals, according to the AMA guides and according to the statute, with some affliction of a body part or body system. It deals with physical injury. Whereas disability, as it's been used in the state of Texas under the old law, disabilities to how an injury impacts the ability to earn. Now, I would submit that the Court of Appeals got off on this very issue because they denounced this system as a pure impairment-based system. It is not. The first 2 years, the temporary income benefits, and the record is clear on this, that under the study papers, that over 76% of the workers under the old system, all they required was temporary income benefits and health benefits. They never got into the supplemental benefits provided under the old law. What they said, though, this is a pure impairment-based system, and it's not. You've got 2 years where wage replacement, a classic method of workers' compensation remuneration, is used. You then have impairment income benefits. Those are not simply based upon damage to the body because it takes into account the actual lost wages. Actual lost wages is also a classic method under workers' compensation for replacing a portion of a worker's wage as a result of an industrial accident. So to call this a pure impairment statute is in fact wrong. The statute has 7 benefits that are potentially available. Out of those 7, only 2 involve the guides at all. The impairment income benefit involves the guide because once the doctor or once the commission has made a determination of the percentage of impairment of the physical body, you're entitled to 3 weeks times each point of impairment. Then you multiply that times a percentage of your average weekly wage. That tells you if you get 30 weeks, 40 weeks, whatever the number is. Then when you get into supplemental income benefits, that is where all the debate over the 15% threshold. And that is its only use in supplemental income benefits, is to distinguish between those that the legislature believed were more severely medically impaired than those who weren't. Now the court and the plaintiffs have jumped on that and they said it's arbitrary. There was no evidence to support the 15% threshold. I will submit to you there is no evidence to support the 55 mile an hour speed limit. There is no evidence to support various lines that the legislature is required to draw. And as a matter of fact, the testimony in this record is that 15% is a reasonable line for the legislature to say that distinguishes in our mind between those who are significantly, permanently impaired and those who aren't.
Well, there was evidence from the Florida study that it would eliminate benefits to 93% of the workers.
There was evidence from Florida study, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs couldn't even establish the basis for the study. It was admitted into evidence over our objection. It also, they excluded the study that showed that, as a matter of fact, under SB 1, there would be more benefits paid to more workers. But that was excluded, and the Court of Appeals said that if it was wrongly excluded, it wasn't harmful error. So the Florida study, nobody could even testify about the exact basis for the numbers. But I would submit also that in question of the guides and the question of gaps in coverage and all of that, if that is constitutional, if that is a constitutional challenge, we operated under an unconstitutional comp law since 1913. That was not an all-inclusive law when it was enacted. It was not an all-inclusive law in 1950. There were many injuries. For example, industrial diseases were not even covered under our comp law until fairly late in its history. The question of mental trauma was still an open question under the old comp law. What SB 1 says is, whatever the law was before, it still is. So it hadn't changed that. All I'm saying is, this act is being held to a standard that I would submit that no comprehensive act can pass. And that standard is that you must address every conceivable problem under every conceivable fact situation, and you must do it from day one, and it must be so clear from the statute that there can be no argument about its impact on a particular claimant. I will submit to you there is no law that has ever been passed that will survive that sort of scrutiny. Now, there's also a complaint made in this case with regard to the jury trial questions. I would submit that a careful examination of the jury trial provisions of this act will clearly establish that an injured worker has the right to have a jury determine every issue of fact that they could determine under the old law. There are differences. One is that the jury is not allowed to compromise on the question of the amount of impairment to the body.
Isn't that quite significant?
It is. I'm not indicating it as a de minimis change, but I would submit to you that the legislature often says what a jury can consider in the way of evidence. They clearly decide what is relevant and irrelevant, and under many statutes, by the way they write the law. And I see no difference here in simply saying that the jury will choose between the scientific evidence that is presented.
Is there any restriction on what the legislature can do in that regard in saying that some evidence cannot be considered?
Well, Your Honor, I'm trying to think of a case in which I think that it's ever been held unconstitutional for the legislature to put it off limits. And quite frankly, I think of none offhand, but I'll certainly think about it some more. I can't think of a situation in which the legislature has said what the issues are to try, where the court has said, no, you can't restrict the issues to that. For example, Middleton, I think, very clearly said that you preserve jury trial as long as there is an appeal where you try the issues made under the act. That's exactly what this does in terms of an injured worker. And I believe that the whole jury trial issue in this instance is, in fact, a red herring. There are differences.
Surely the legislature couldn't eliminate all fact issues.
No, sir. I don't believe that's true. I don't think they could say that there are no fact issues. I don't know how they decide who wins, but anyway.
Well, can they raise the burden enough to where it essentially makes a jury trial unfeasible or increases the burden to the point where it's so difficult that it is, for practical purposes, non-existent?
I suppose. Well, I don't know. Sitting here thinking about it, I guess they could raise it above, beyond a reasonable doubt, perhaps, and therefore pretty well foreclose a jury from any determination. But, Justice Corn, I'd say in this case, we're nowhere close to that. It's still preponderance of the evidence. And what we really have is a question. And let me say, this wasn't just a whim on the part of the legislature to say you've got to choose between these doctors. There's a lot of testimony that one of the problems And one of the things that created great controversy and transaction cost in the system were so-called dueling doctors who couldn't come up with it, and then too often that was the source of appeals to the court. And I think this is simply one way the legislature thought they could address that, and I believe it was a permissible way. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Wait a minute. I still got a little...
You do?
Excuse me. Let me go to one other thing on the AMA. Back on the AMA guides, and then hush up about the... I would submit to the court that the AMA ought to be held to what they say in the guides themselves. And what they say in the guides themselves is they are the preeminent authoritative guide for the determination of physical impairment to the body. And that's exactly, the legislature took them at their word on their own statements. And I would submit that that is what the AMA ought to be held to, and that's what the authors who testified in this case should be held to. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Mr. Richards, Mr. Whitehurst will present argument for respondents. Mr. Richards will open with the first 22 minutes.
May it please the court, I had a little prepared remarks, but I can't always end up jumping on the last remarks of my opponent, and I guess I will say we're going to try to hold the AMA to what they said too, and I think we ought to be able to hold the legislature to what the AMA said, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I was going to try to pose a question which seems to me is fairly based on the record in this case, and hopefully will link into your most recent decision in Trinity River Authority. And that is, may the legislature, consistent with the Texas Constitution, adopt a scheme predicated upon medical certitude, and in the process act in defiance of the very body of medical knowledge upon which it purports to rely. And I think that's what they've done here. Now, this court, most recently in Trinity River, formulated an open court's analysis is a current statutory restriction on common law rights reasonable and balanced against the purpose and basis of the statute. Now, I assume when I talk about this that the author of that opinion was the Chief Justice, and he was also the author of a dissent in Lucas in which the Chief Justice's opinion said that this was going to be a searching inquiry, and I assume this is still a searching inquiry when open court's rights under the Texas Constitution are implicated. The purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is both by statute, by legislative history, and by decisions of this court is a replacement of lost earnings or lost earning capacity, not total, but at least that's the purpose of the act. The record here establishes that. The testimony of the experts and state attest to that. This court's opinion in Paradisus says just that. Now, so that's the purpose of the act. If basis means what I think basis means in Trinity Valley, the basis of this statutory scheme is the legislature's attempt to make this a medical, purely medical standard. Thus, under the statute, Section 4.25 and talks about impairment, and by the way, I'll come back to it, but impairment is the linchpin of virtually all the benefits under this act. Quote, there must be evidence of impairment based on an objective clinical or laboratory finding. And then it goes on, and then in defining objective clinical or laboratory based on competent objective medical evidence. And of course, this impairment finding, as you know, must be found or derived from the third edition of the AMA guides. I don't know if you can read that, but what does that third edition say about this impairment number? And this is where I think we can hold the legislature to having at least had to read the AMA guides when they enacted them in such an all-determinative fashion. A simple number, I'm quoting from the guides themselves, a simple number, the impairment rating, although it may be derived from a well-structured set of observations, does not convey any information about the person or the impact of the impairment on the person's capacity to meet personal, social, or occupational demands. In fact, information is lost in arriving at that number, at the number. Now, that's what the AMA guides said about the number that it can be generated from the AMA guides. Now, and I would say to you, I know we indulge the legislature, and I know there's a great body of law of presuming that they had a rational basis for their action. But can we presume in this instance that they could reject the very caveat that the AMA said about the danger of this number, that they could disregard that totally and take this number, i.e. the impairment rating, import it into a statutory scheme, the purpose of which, by everyone's account, is to provide replacement earnings for people who are disabled, who suffer on-the-job injuries or illness. I just doesn't seem to me you can make the fit. And when Mr. Ratliff says, or Mr. Hicks, they always want to say, well, there are all these other factors in here other than the impairment rating, but if you look at this statute with any care, it is apparent that in Tier 2 benefits, I call it Tier 2 because it's just simpler, the only benefit you get is a benefit if you get an impairment number. If you get an impairment number under these guides, then you get a benefit which is calculated by multiplying 3 times the impairment number. If you don't get an impairment number, you get no benefits. When you move to the third tier benefits, those benefits which were designed presumably to take care of the most severely disabled, the people who are continuing to lose earnings, when you reach that benefit level, you can't get there. You simply cannot ever qualify for consideration for those benefits unless you achieve a 15% impairment rating. Now, under the AMA guides, that is a number. You have to hit this number, which the guides say doesn't tell you anything about the person.
Could this act be constitutionally applied to a worker who is injured and who receives temporary income benefits, say for 6 months, and returns to work with no residual impairment or disability?
It has always seemed to us that the critical problem was the exclusion. Yes. Obviously, there are circumstances that reasonably apply. I don't mean to say that.
So, if that's true, do you agree this is a facial challenge to the Act?
I agree. I mean, I'm not sure what all, that's a fairly freighted term. This is an attack upon the statute utilizing the declaratory judgment procedures of the Texas law, which is, I think, similar to attacking Miller. It does attempt to address the problems at the outset.
The United States Supreme Court, I don't think our court has ever really explicitly said what the standard is in a facial constitutional challenge. But the United States Supreme Court said that the burden in a facial challenge is to show that under no set of circumstances could the Act be constitutionally applied. If that's the same standard, you concede that this there are some circumstances under which this Act could be constitutionally applied.
Well, excuse me, the jury trial provisions in our view could never be constitutionally applied. The hybrid review provisions could never be constitutionally applied. Those are, it seems to us,
even for a worker who's injured and returns to work and who does not seek a jury trial or impairment application of the impairment guidelines?
Well, I mean, I suppose, I mean, I don't mean to be totally, it seems to me the way you phrase it, you have turned on its head the question. If it cannot be constitutionally...
One nice thing is we get to ask the question.
And we have to struggle with the answer. I think the answer to that clearly cannot be the test, that you can conceive of no circumstances in which it can be constitutionally applied. It cannot be constitutionally applied to Texas workers. That's our view of it. And it cannot be constitutionally applied to Texas workers for example, who suffer injuries for which they're entitled to be, they would have had a common law cause of action. That's our view.
You referenced Middleton. Wouldn't a ruling by this court now approving your view of the law conflict with what this court said in Middleton?
In what respect, Your Honor?
Well, in its upholding a statute that seems to be far less comprehensive than this one and limiting the right of trial by jury there.
The jury trial provisions existed in Middleton at the time of Middleton. And how were they more limited, Your Honor?
Well, let me just ask you if the provision in Middleton in any way conflicts with what you're saying you want this court to do today.
Yes, I don't. Yes, clearly it does. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that it did not. My point was only, I think the better text is LeBaum, frankly, for our purposes, because and LeBaum is the one that reads Middleton the way we would read, as we believe the law to be. I'm not sure I've answered you correctly on that. Middleton was decided in 1917, and I take it we have not even at that point particularly had involved in open court's analysis in this state. Practical matter.
Regards the 15%.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any limit the legislature could have set in your view?
I mean, I think the problem here is, in part, that it's not related to what it's designed to fit. It doesn't fit. Could it have set, it could set a limit clearly to provide impairment. The problem is, it is designed to, if you flow through the tier three benefits, you don't ever get the benefits unless you're disabled. If you read it, if you return to work and you're earning at 80%, and this is not totally responsible, I think, 80% of your earnings, you don't get tier three benefits. You have to be out of work and unable to earn 80% to even get the benefit. The problem with the 15% is, it cuts out, according to this record and according to medical testimony, it imposes an arbitrary figure upon even being entitled to be considered for Tier 3 benefits.
But
could there be a number?
It seems to me that argument works just as well for 5% or 1% or any number.
Well, it may or may not. It's clear that on this record, that there is no, that 15% is a number that excludes enormous numbers of severely disabled people from consideration.
But any number will have that same effect to some extent. And my question is, does your argument mean that the legislature could not, based on what we know about the statute so far, have picked any number?
Well, I guess, let me say it this way. To the extent that we know that we know that there are people who are disabled who can't get any number. That is, there are conditions which the impairment and the AMA testify that don't even apply. The one that the other courts, state courts have dealt with, for example, is contact dermatitis, which is not rated in the guides whatsoever, but it is an injury that is severely disabled, and a person could be permanently disabled with contact dermatitis, achieve no impairment number, and never achieve any benefits under Tier 2 or Tier 3 of this statutory scheme because of its insistence upon the attainment of an impairment number. So to that extent, it could not. No number would be constitutional to a person suffering. Well, the other obvious example is mental trauma, although the statute says mental trauma will still be compensated. You can't get an impairment rating under the guides for mental trauma. So as a practical matter, it cannot be compensated. So,
and then along the same lines, I take it would also be true that in your view, the legislature did not adopt a statute that did not take into account the personal realities of an illness, that is, as opposed to the objective trying to measure it for classes of injuries.
I'm not too sure I would be painted totally into that corner. could they create, the question means, could they adopt a total impairment system unrelated to disability? I guess that's where that takes you. I suspect one could. I don't think I have to make that argument today. It doesn't address what the statute is designed to address, that is lost earning capacity, although it might be, one could argue, a monitor of it. But the point here is not that you could not adopt an impairment system. The point here is that they have tied an impairment system to a number generated under the AMA guides that the AMA says do not provide you any information, as the AMA says are not for this purpose, and indeed work injustice and hardship and are arbitrary in their application.
Well,
now, could there be another impairment number generated through some set of circumstances that might enable it to really canvas and produce numbers that were relevant to an injury? Perhaps so.
So you're not arguing that the only choice the legislature has is
a pure disability system? No, I would not seem to me. We can't reasonably say that, although I would don't think we have to make that argument today. I guess is the way I see it. The Texas case, just for example, I think I can put my hands on it. Perhaps I can't. Henry Francis Haddock case, 511 Southwest 102, was a contact dermatitis case, total impairment under the old act. The man was working in a garage, had been given a solvent for which his employer gave to him and said, you use this to clean these parts. The effect of using that solvent was immediate severe contact dermatitis. He couldn't work ever again around any gasoline, petroleum, or related products. Total and permanent under the old act, clearly a kind of cause of action, seems to me that would have been a common law cause of action for, under the theories of safe workplace. Now that person, for example, under this statute, cannot get benefits. May or may not get temporary income benefits. We addressing that problem is a construction of the statute. I don't think he may get temporary income benefits. Could not get second tier benefits. Could not get third tier benefits. The FERC, in dealing with that, said, "Oh, we can't apply our statute in this fashion. We just can't do it to a statute that excludes that kind of injury, or if that's what the AMA guides result. We can't apply it." And so I know that walks me into the kind of problem that's been raised somewhat here. Why can't we just do this on case-by-case litigation down the line? Well, I mean, if this statute is going to be 10 years down the line denying the people benefits unfairly, I would urge that it's time to try to address those problems now. I don't know who's going to litigate those cases down the line. Under this statutory scheme, these cases may never reach the courthouse. It is clear under this statute if Mr. Haddock would not be able to get an impairment rating and would get no benefits, although he was clearly, as the court said then, totally and permanently disabled, and he could get no benefits, I'm sorry, could get no tier two or tier three benefits under this statute, under its literal language, and there's no wiggle room. No court can even approve a settlement under this statute that doesn't adopt an impairment rating generated under the AMA guide. And if you can't generate an impairment rating under the AMA guide, you cannot get benefits in Tier 2 or Tier 3 of this statute. And that is a severe limitation upon the rights of workers and a severe limitation on common law rights. The question is with respect to the other state...
If the statute covers... I know this is not your position, but if you covered everything but contact dermatitis, but your position is there are some other things it doesn't cover. But if it covers a raft of things and does not conceitedly cover others, where, no matter how small that is, does that make the statute constitutionally perfect?
This was the argument, I think, in Lucas in part. Justice Gonzales' dissent, I think, said that you can't necessarily insist upon a each individual analysis. On the other hand, as I read his dissent, it said that is a factor to consider in determining whether you have a reasonable replacement. That's what I think. I'll take that safe niche, if that's a safe niche, and sort of say that is a factor to look at in trying to determine. Now, as we know in the statute and the other courts that have dealt with it, it doesn't take into account chronic pain. And I'm going to personalize this. I've had a rotator cuff injury that has kept me from virtually doing anything for a year and a half, and yet I had full range of motion. I mean, tears came into my eyes, but I had full range of motion. And I would not have been able to get a impairment rating under this statute. Unfortunately, I'm a scrivener in the law, and so it didn't affect me in my earning capacity, but anybody else who had to work for a living, it would just flat taken them out. But I had to, it would not have produced an impairment rating. It would not have produced any benefits. Every state court, and since it came up and we've had late amicus, I'd like the courts at least summarize the other state court opinions. I've read them all that I can find, and every state court that's faced this problem, and even the federal courts that's faced it under the Longshoremen's Act, have found the same problem, that you cannot apply these guides literally. Now, that unfortunately, that's what our statute requires. No other state does it in the same, done it in the same draconian fashion that our statute does, and no state has generated anything approaching the 15% threshold that we say, in effect, is a gatekeeper for third-tier benefits and forecloses enormous numbers of people from being considered, and that's this record testimony. It is bolstered by the AMA guys themselves when they say to you, we don't, this number is a number that tells you nothing about the individual, and yet we have taken that number and given it sort of all-determining force.
Isn't there a savings clause in the Act itself?
There's a savings clause in the Act which says that should you find that reliance upon the third edition, second printing, or whatever, or should it ever be declared unconstitutional, it empowers then the commission to adopt a replacement impairment scheme. Now, adopting the replacement impairment scheme might or might not be sufficient, but there clearly is that. And whether that raises...
Why shouldn't, given what the Court of Appeals found, the gravamen of what we're arguing today that you allege is wrong with the Act, why, even if you're right, wasn't that the appropriate remedy that the lower courts should have imposed?
It's with respect to the guides, we have never addressed the issue of delegation here and whether that, or we have not adequately addressed it, and whether that raises delegation problems has always been a question in our minds, and frankly, within the page limitations and all the issues we've had, I suppose we've never adequately briefed that question. I would suggest to you that would be one problem. The second problem is it would be our view, obviously, with respect to the guide, that no guides that imposed a 15% threshold to get benefits could ever be constitutionally applied, because it just didn't or does not work. And let me, in closing on the 15%, it is suggested that, two things. Counsel suggests that there was record testimony supporting the AMA, the 15%. That simply is not true. There was an economist who said it might be reasonable, but we're talking about a medical standard. No doctor said it was reasonable. Every doctor said it was unreasonable, and I think it's that what the medical profession says about the 15% that's going to be, should be determined here in light of its statutory scheme is based upon medical assumptions. If it was designed to weed out people who could work or were actually earning, that's covered by the rest of the scheme. In order to get there, you have to have the 15%, but then if you're still earning at 80% of your pre-injury wage, you don't get benefits anyway. So that crowd is going to get weeded out by the balance of Tier 3. It's the using the impairment test initially to even get consideration that we would find offensive, I think, under any scheme, would be unfair. If the 15% went out, then you would have a vastly different matter. If you had an impairment system that was truly based on, that permitted everyone to show that they were impaired, even if they didn't fit in the guise, and you didn't have the 15%, you might very well have a different breed of cat.
Now, let me be sure I understand. But if you didn't have the 15%, but you were still relying on the guides, statute now does, it might be all right.
No, let me say that, Your Honor. To the extent the guides do not cover, to the extent the guides do not cover injuries, we would still have the same problem.
But otherwise, to the extent the guides do cover,
our concern is that people who are truly disabled, and that's just the testimony in this record, never get considered for Tier 3 benefits. And the 15% threshold, as this record establishes and the medical testimony shows, cuts out an enormous number of truly disabled people, not from benefits, but from consideration, which is a different matter. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Please support. My name is Bill Whitehurst, and I would like to address the right to jury trial issues and the hybrid system of review issues. This court has often discussed and written on the right to jury trial as late as 1993. Justice Cornyn in TAB versus Air Control Board said that Article 1, Section 15 preserves a right to a trial by jury for those actions or analogous actions tried to a jury at the time the Constitution of 1876 was adopted. In Texas, unlike a lot of states, the right to jury trial has taken on special significance. It's in two places in our Constitution, also under the Judiciary Article, which actually broadens the right to jury trial in Texas. The right to a jury trial is not in dispute in this case. I think everyone, all parties, agreeing that the Constitution requires that there be a jury trial. The question is whether the act in question provides a jury trial in the full constitutional sense. And this court has at least alluded to that in White versus White, where it says that entitlement to a jury trial under the Texas Constitution must be in the full constitutional sense. And that's an interesting case because what they did is they traced back the origin of the jury trial back to the Magna Carta and noted that it has a sacred place in both our English and American history. So it's one that has given, that is not just any right, but it is a fundamental right.
I'm interested in the White case in regard to its specific facts, which was the right to determine whether somebody was mentally confident or not could not be taken away from the jury and delegated to experts. How does the designated doctor provision under the Act survive under what? Under that analysis?
Well, I don't think it can survive under what.
The designated doctor's decision is given presumptive effect.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that if you have a doctor who has treated an individual for 2 years conservatively, decides that he needs to do back surgery, actually conducts the operation and sees within him when he conducts the operation the defect in his body, sews him up, follows him, goes through rehabilitation and therapy, and then gives an impairment rating. And then they can bring in someone who has never seen this patient to give it a rating under the guides, and that designated doctor has a presumption of correctness in his impairment rating. The doctor who has treated and followed this patient for 2 or 3 years has a presumption of incorrectness.
But who gets to look at the presumption and what overcomes the presumption?
Well, you can look at both the doctors, and you can consider that, but unless you can find that...
You the jury?
Yes, initially it would be the contested case hearing officer, then the appeals panel, and then the result, of course, goes to the jury. Those are admissible under the rules of this act and would go to the jury. So the jury is also apprised of the presumption of correctness and likewise the presumption of incorrectness.
But it's different than White, what this issue is taken away from the jury altogether.
Well, it's virtually taken away from the jury altogether. They can only pick one of the others. That they can only pick one of two or three numbers. They can't say that this particular expert is correct on this issue but not on this issue and pick and choose as in the traditional jury trial. what's important to understand in our writers of our Constitution were wise, in that in this legislation, unabashedly, the legislature wanted to do away with the jury trial. They make no bones about it. The debate is very clear. And so they were left with trying to devise ways around it so that they could, quote, comply with the Constitution. The result was a scheme that we simply have never had in our jurisprudence. And it's one that uses a 12-person jury, but really in name only. It gives it a label. It's a facade. It's a scheme, in our opinion, that makes a mockery of the right to trial by jury. What they have done is they've combined a number of issues into one lawsuit with different standards of review, and they've done it in a very limited way. Jury's role is limited to two issues. One is compensability. The other is regarding the amount of income or death benefits. So preponderance of the evidence, they say, attaches to those two issues. Later, they further restrict those, and I'll discuss those. The, all the other issues in the case, except one, is under the substantial evidence test, including reasonable and necessary medical expenses. Now, there's another issue called change of condition, where by the time the individual comes to trial, there's been a change in his condition that can come up in the trial. The Act recognizes that. That is a fact issue that has to be decided under the guidelines by the judge. So the jury fact finders do not get to try all fact issues in this case. The judge will make that issue on the preponderance of the evidence standard. It cannot be on a substantial evidence test because no commission agency has made that decision before. And then and only then, acting as really an administrative agent of the commission, I submit, can that go before the jury. So what they did is they devised the scheme, then they further applied further restrictions, in effect creating a substantial evidence review, I submit, with a preponderance label. What they said is that it's going to be limited to the issues before the contested case hearing in the appeals panel. The jury is going to be advised of the appeals panel decision on each disputed issue, on each disputed issue. So the jury is going to be influenced. And I'm a trial lawyer. I understand how this is going to be argued. It's going to be argued like you'd argue a substantial evidence review. The commission has done this. They've been in this business for years. They know what they're doing. Give deference to the commission. No other jury trial that I can think of utilizes this technique. You must choose one of the doctors who actually examined the patient, and you can only use that impairment number in determining income benefits. You pick one or the other. You cannot review or look at or combine, use your own logic. And the presumption of correctness, as Justice Phillips pointed out, becomes an issue as well for the jury. Now, not only was the legislature distrustful of the jury system, but they were very distrustful of this court. And they put in two provisions specifically related to the trial for this court. Section 6.62, C5, says that notwithstanding Section 22.04 of the Government Code, which is the rulemaking authority, or any other law, the Supreme Court of Texas may not adopt or promulgate rules in conflict with or inconsistent with this section. In Section 6.62, they say to the extent this section conflicts with the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure or any other rules promulgated or adopted by the Supreme Court of Texas, this section controls. What this does is take away, for the first time in our jurisprudence, the traditional historic role of the jury. Certainly as a basis, the whole purpose of a jury trial is so that we can have 12 citizens who can use their own common sense and logic in the process.
You're not arguing that without medical testimony, the jury could, in our jurisprudence, assess an impairment rating without medical testimony.
Well, I think you would have to have medical testimony to do that.
So your only argument is that because there's case precedent that permits a jury verdict to stand when the verdict is obviously a compromise between the extremes testified to by the experts,
you're saying that translates into a full constitutional meaning for the jury, that if the legislature decides that in this instance we will not permit them to compromise between the extremes of the experts, they're going to have to pick one or the other. You say that that infringes upon the constitutional breadth of the jury trial.
I think that's one of the things it does, and the court has so indicated in Hood versus Hood, which says that the character of testimony is but evidentiary and is never binding upon the trier of facts, not bound to adopt all conclusions of any one expert, could adopt them in part and reject them in part. If you take that away from a jury, certainly you have intruded upon the traditional role of a jury.
Mr. Winters, it sounds like that your complaint can be categorized under the general heading of the legislature has impermissibly increased the burden on the injured worker, the burden of proof, in order to obtain a compensation award. And I guess if that's true, to what extent can the legislature increase the burden of proof in a civil case without running into the prohibition in White, that is, providing a jury trial in the full constitutional sense?
Well, I think, and I noticed you raised that earlier, and I think your point's well taken, is that clearly what's happened here is they have raised indirectly the threshold. Certainly there are different kinds of cases that have different burdens of proof in our jurisprudence. I think, though, if you look back at the common law, the burden of proof was a preponderance of the evidence. And that is the jury trial in that instance, I think, was a preponderance of the evidence, and we shouldn't raise it in this. Whether it rises to the level of unconstitutionality, I can't really say, but I would assert that it does.
Well, at some point, I guess, on the continuum, you would say that it's finally gotten too high, and so it's unconstitutional under White, because it deprives you of the jury trial in the full constitutional sense. But the legislature could say, rather than a preponderance of the evidence, you have to prove your case by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, I know they have done that in certain instances. I would question whether they could do that where you have an analogous proceeding at common law that was a different standard. That would be the only issue I would raise on that. The Act also creates a hybrid court of review or hybrid system of review, which this court has repeatedly said you cannot do. You cannot have substantial evidence, and you cannot have trial by jury under presumption of evidence or without in both hearings, in both in one suit, in one trial. This case clearly does that. This court has repeatedly said and consistently said I know of no cases which have permitted that and should not permit it in this instance.
Counsel, assuming you're right as to one or more points, for the court to conclude that you are, the court does not feel that the substantive provisions of the Act, the way the commission and its various process it goes about making its determinations unconstitutional, wouldn't the severability clause say the Act as a whole? If the jury had to be allotted somewhat more discretion than this Act gives, if the judge had to perform his or her functions in a different way?
I think you could sever the jury trial issue here. You would have to do some work in doing that, but that could be severed.
But, I mean, wouldn't that be our responsibility under the severability clause?
Yes, I think that's true. The issue, though, with the guides is another matter, because the guides permeate every aspect of this Act. I mean, they're from the income benefits, from the benefits that you get, to the adjudicatory scheme, to the jury trial issue. The guides permeate all aspects of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Richards seemed to criticize the movement from disability-based or wage replacement-based situation under the old Act and say, in essence, that the state is bound by the purpose set in the old Act as that being the purpose of the workers' compensation system under the new Act. I want to remind the court, before I get into the details of the response on that, that wage replacement is an integral part of the new act at every tier of the benefits. Every tier, the second and third tiers, as Mr. Richards refers to them as one of the places. But the legislature, if it wants impairment as the basis for one leg or one part of the compensation system, which it did, it has the right to do that. Mr. Richards, I think, acknowledged to Justice Hecht that that was so. He seemed to acknowledge there could be an impairment system that would be acceptable, and he couldn't really argue otherwise. And that's what's happened here. The legislature was told all these things. It isn't a matter of not reading the guides. The legislature was directly told some of the things Mr. Richards read to you from the guides about how to use them, and they said that's right, and that's how we want to use them. We want to use them for an impairment-based system. I want to talk a little bit about this question about conditions or gaps in the guides. Mental trauma was mentioned. A perfect example of the dangers of deciding everything today or whenever the court goes and decides this case after this argument about what this act means now and forevermore ties into the mental trauma issue. Chapter 14 of the guides that we're tied to has a section on mental trauma. And Chapter 14 of those guides says mental trauma is something that can create impairment. It's difficult to do, and it discusses a lot of factors, and then it essentially says, doctors, you can do something about this. It doesn't set out a detailed rating scheme, but it seems to me that mental trauma, we may find out, is something that can be rated in accordance with the guides, as Section 4.24 says to do. We may have an individual case come up where a doctor has given a rating in accordance with the guides. We may have a case situation come up where the board or the commission promulgates rules saying, well, mental trauma is in the guides. We're going to give some more details on the rating system. That just shows.
Does the AMA from time to time revise the guides?
It does, and there's a new edition out, I believe, now.
Does the revision take effect as far as this act is concerned?
I don't think so.
This act placed in place the guides as of the time of its enactment.
Yes, it specifies the particular guides that we're to look to. Again, what it means to have a rating system in accordance with, which is the language of the statute, those guides that are specified, remains to be seen, I think. I don't know if it means you can't go outside it in any particular Chapter 14, the mental trauma chapter. It seems to me you can give a rating in accordance with the guides. It may very well turn out that you can. I want to talk about the 15% threshold for a second. Again, Justice Hecht, in a colloquy with Mr. Richards, was asking him to acknowledge that it's surely a line, he didn't put it this way, but basically surely a line can be drawn somewhere along the continuum on the impairment rating. And I think the answer is, of course it can, and there are reasons for it. Drawing a line somewhere, 15%, 5%, 12.5%, wherever it may be, to kick into the final level of benefits here, income benefits, drawing a line somewhere can create an incentive to get the workers back into the workplace, and it's an incentive where you don't have to have the detailed monitoring costs at the bureaucratic level of keeping track of filings by these people that they're looking for a job and so on. It is an incentive to get people back into the workplace, which is one of the goals of the Act, set up a system where people can get back into the workplace. Also,
this Act has now been in force in effect for about 3 years, and there is data. Do you think it would be proper for the court to take judicial notice of the amount of claims, the size of the awards that have been made?
I think
the
it's
number of people who are back at work and at what rate of their old income. Have some of the amicus briefs have given us that information, or is that outside our purview?
Well, if the court's going to look at the trial record and take it into account in making its decision, it seems to me it also has to look at the data that's in the public domain in the 3 years of implementation of the Act, because otherwise we have surmises about what might happen compared to actual events of what did happen. It seems appropriate to take that into account. I don't have much time, I can see. I wanted the medical benefits question on the jury, right, the jury trial issue. Mr. Whitehurst, I think, said that's an issue that would be under substantial evidence. I don't think that's at all clear that the degree of medical or the amount of medical benefits would never go to the jury under the preponderance of the evidence test. Section 1.03, subpart 11, I think it is, of The definition section talks about compensation, and medical benefits are one of the things defined there. And it seems to me that falls within the compensability issue that can go to the jury. It's at least plausible reading of the statute, so I don't think it can be determined that that doesn't go to the jury. In terms of the burden of proof question, the Credit Bureau of Laredo case is a perfect situation where there was a determination that there was still a right to jury trial. This, I think it's a 1975 decision of this court. There was still a right to, there was a right to jury trial in this deceptive trade practice setting, because the court analogized it to prior kinds of civil penalties. And in that case, though, when the court then got into questions about who had the burden of proof on a particular issue, it didn't say, well, historically, who would have had the burden of proof, or did this change it in unacceptable ways? It looked to the statute itself. It looked to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to see how the burden of proof was set out. I also think there's a question about whether the statute, substantial question about whether the statute raises the burden of proof anyway for workers as it's been characterized. It seems to me, I don't see how it does raise the burden of proof. In some instances, when you go into court under the new statute, the burden of proof could be on the comp carrier, because they would have been the ones that, so to speak, lost at the administrative level. I think, finally, I just point out the basic problem that we face were the court to accept what the plaintiffs are asking across the board on the statute in terms of its invalidation. I think it's clear that what the plaintiffs are arguing for, both on the jury trial issue, on the way the guides are used, and the way the pigeonholes, so to speak, are worked out in the statute, they're arguing that as a constitutional matter, in Texas, you cannot develop an objective-based system. It may tie in ultimately to individuals, but you can't develop an objective-based system, which was the very reason for getting rid of the old statute. To adopt what the plaintiffs have said here as the constitutional standards, both on jury trial and again on the use of the guides and calculation of some of the income benefits, it seems to me would put the legislature in such a constitutional straitjacket that it could never escape and get into a workable system as the legislature deems it, that is, as it looked back at the old system and saw that there was no standardization across the board, that there were completely unpredictable results across the board from one part of the state to another, from one case to another. It was very individualized, highly individualized, and it wasn't unconstitutional because of that, but it did present major problems. And that's what led to the change. And the plaintiffs, in essence, when you get right down to it, are griping about that in this case and saying it's unconstitutional to have an objective system. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take